Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Reverend Don Lewis coming to you from witchschool.com. Are you looking for the best in pagan and magical education? With more than 12,000 pages, witchschool.com is like having your own personal library with individual learning assistants to help you study. And Witchschool's Anyone, Anytime, Anywhere education system is available any place on earth, anywhere you are and anytime you want it, as long as you have an internet connection. Witchschool's lifetime memberships are a great value. They really do last a lifetime. They've been there for years, and they'll be there for years to come. So get your membership today at witchschool.com.
You're listening to Pagans Tonight. Pagans unite on Pagans Tonight. Many paths, one network. For over 5 years, we've been the place to connect with the best, brightest, and most trusted voices in the pagan world. Every night is Pagans Tonight.
Welcome to the Soapbox Witch. I'm your host, Onyx. Thank you for joining me on this magical journey of thought seed farming. You had a choice, and you chose to spend time with me.
Good evening, and welcome to yet another episode of the Soapbox Witch. I am Onyx. This episode is airing on the 10th of October, 2015. I do want to thank you for listening, whether you're here in the chat room with us, whether you're listening through one of the other outlets through Facebook or through any of the other outlets there, or later in the archives. It's all the same thing, and I really, really do appreciate you tuning in. The advantage to coming into the chat room here at blogtalkradio.com/witchschool during the time that we're airing is that if you have a Blog Talk Radio account, you can get into the chat room and you can interact with all the other people here in the chat room. And if you are not in the chat room, you're missing part of the show, because a lot of times the chat can follows what's going on the radio, and other times it does not. And there are a lot of times that some very interesting things get put in the chat room, some of which I can mention on the air and some of which I cannot, and that's not because of any restrictions. It's just because I have a propensity for trying not to watch the chat room too awful much when I'm actively speaking. One of those things that I can't walk and chew chewing gum at the same time. So for that, I apologize, but there are plenty of people in the chat room with wonderful points of view, wonderful opinions, wonderful thoughts. Please, if you get a chance, on Saturday nights, I'm here on Pagans Tonight Radio Network with the Blog Talk Radio, with the Soapbox Witch. That's blogtalkradio.com/witchschool. Saying that, I want to thank Pagans Tonight Radio Network for allowing the Soapbox Witch here on this Blog Talk Network. It's certainly an honor to be here. I would also like to mention that there are plenty of other places that you can catch my ramblings. If you'd like to know more about me, then you can go to revonix.com. You'll find out a little bit about me there. LadyOfTheCircle.org is another website where you can find out about Lady of the Circle in the Oaks, which is the proto-temple out of Davidson County, North Carolina, where a lot of things happen. You can also go onto Facebook, find me there. I'm Chuck Chapman in Thomasville, North Carolina. And from there, you can find a myriad of things that I'm connected with. I believe the largest project, I would have to say that the largest project that I'm involved with currently is International Pagan Radio. If you have not checked out International Pagan Radio, or you don't know what it is, let me give you a real quick dump on it. International Pagan Radio is an internet broadcasting station. It's a streaming station It runs through the Live 365 architecture. That means that you can get it online. You can find the channel by going to internationalpaganradio.com, or you can download the Live 365 app on your Android or iDevices and search for International Pagan Radio. There again, over there, I would invite you to become a member of Live 365. Live 365 membership is free. With the free membership, you can vote for the different elements, the different songs that you like. There's a thumbs up and thumbs down. Let us know here in the staff what you like and what you don't like. That helps us to determine what we actually put on the air. I should say on the stream, because it's not an air broadcast radio. We have a wonderful media manager by the name of William Wrigley, who is working miracles in getting more and more and various artists on stream with us. And we've got people like Chronolus, like Tav Shear, Straight from the Heart. I can't keep going. I'm into S.J. Tucker, Wendy Rule, Dave the Bard, plenty of different artists. And if I missed anybody, I don't mean to miss anybody, but I can't possibly name all the different artists that we have there. We also have several shows there. Go to the internationalpaganradio.com, the schedule page. You'll get a chance to see which shows we have. But enough of that. We're here on Pagans Tonight Radio Network, and that's what we're doing tonight. And I want to thank each and every one of you for being here tonight, and remind all the people that you know that we are here every Saturday night. And if you can't catch us live, then check us out in the archive. Tonight, I'm going to be talking about the myth of the Golden Age. Now, this is from a piece that I worked as a series of pieces talking about the development of ritual and religion over the ages. And it's a standalone piece, so no worries there. The tradition of the Golden Age is extremely widespread throughout the world, throughout history. It's not necessary at all for us to go to any length into the story of the Garden of Eden and any of the other legends, which in almost every country illustrate this Golden Age tradition. We can say that it is not unlikely that this tradition is supported by the memory among the people of every race of a pre-civilization period of relative harmony and happiness, when two things, which today we consider to be the prolific causes of conflict and misery, were either absent or were only weakly developed. And these two causes throughout the world seem to be property and self-consciousness. During the first century before the Common Era, there was widespread messianic ideas all over the Roman world. In Virgil's fourth eclogue, which is generally called the Messianic Eclogue, it reflects very clearly the state of the public mind. The expected baby in this poem was to be the son of Octavian, the first Roman emperor. A messianic halo surrounded this child in Virgil's verse. Unfortunately, the baby turned out to be a girl. Well, at least for the Romans, that was unfortunate. However, there is very little doubt that Virgil did, in what he called that very sad age of the world, an age of misery and massacre, and in common with thousands of others of that time, look for the coming of a great Redeemer. And it was only a few years earlier, around 70 before Common Era, that the great revolt of the shamefully mistreated Roman slaves occurred, and that in revenge, 6,000 prisoners from Spartacus' army were nailed on crosses all the way from Rome to Capua, a distance of about 150 miles. However, long before this, Hesiod had recorded a past golden age when life had been gracious in communal fraternity and joyful in peace, it was said. An age when human beings and animals spoke the same language. When death had followed on sleep without old age or disease. And after death, men had moved on as good daimons or genii over the lands. Pindar, 300 years after Hesiod, had confirmed the existence of the islands of the blessed, where the good led a blameless, tearless life. Plato, with further references to the fabled island of Atlantis, the Egyptians believed in a former golden age under the god Ra, to which they looked back with regret and envy. The Persians had a Garden of Eden similar to that of the Hebrews. The Greeks, the Garden of Hesperides, in which dwelt the serpent, whose head was ultimately crushed beneath the heel of Hercules, and so on and so on and so on. The references to a supposed far back state of peace and happiness are very, very numerous. They're so numerous that lately, and partly to explain the prevalence of these legends, a theory has been advanced, which might be worth mentioning. It's called the theory of intrauterine blessedness. And remote as it may first appear, it certainly has some claim for attention. In this theory, it's stated that in the minds of mature people, there still remain certain vague memories of their prenatal days in the maternal womb. Memories of a life which, though full of growing vigor and vitality, was at that time one of absolute harmony with the surroundings, and of perfect peace and contentment spent within the body of the mother. The embryo standing in the same relation to the mother, as St. Paul says in the Christian Bible, that we stand to God, quote, in whom we live and move and have our being, end quote. And that these vague memories of the intrauterine life in the individual are referred back by the mature mind to a past age in the life of the race. Though it would not be easy at present to positively confirm this theory, obviously, we can say that it is neither improbable nor unworthy of consideration. The well-known parallelism of the individual history with the race history, the recapitulation by the embryo of the development of the race, does in fact present an additional argument for its favorable reception. These considerations and what has been said often said, the unity of the animals and early man with nature and their instinctive and age-long adjustment to the conditions of the world around them bring us up hard and fast against the following conclusions, which I think we'll find very difficult to avoid. Now, we all recognize the astonishing grace and beauty of the animals. We recognize not only their beauty, but the extreme fitness of their actions and habits to their surroundings.
within the leaf. I'm the voice within the tree. I am boy, I am man, the face of the changing man. And I have been your constant guide from your caves on the mountainside. We have walked hand in hand, and everywhere that I have been, my passing turns to grey to green. The birds sing to the dawn, but the land has awoken, and oh my lady lays with me, and our love weaves a tapestry, eternal thread unbroken. I am lover, I am father, I am haunted god and king. I'm the life in all that is reborn every spring. Call of stag and cry of eagle, I am child of Barleycorn, and I am the antlered crown and standing storm.
Welcome back to the Soapbox Witch. Whether you're live or in the archives, you had a choice. Thank you for choosing to spend time with me.
And you're back here with the Soapbox, which I am Onyx. I am your host. I want to thank you for joining me, whether you're live or in the archives. It's a blessing to have you with me. Tonight, we're talking about the myth of the Golden Age. We're talking about the fall of man. And we're talking about the process of recapitulation. It's what we're going to talk about now. Now, I think that it's evident that in the Golden Age, when man was simply the crown and perfection of the animals, he possessed, in reality, all the essentials of religion. Pardon me for a moment. I don't think it's necessary for us to romanticize over him, the ancient man. He was probably raw and crude in his lusts of hunger and of sex. He was probably or certainly ignorant and superstitious. He loved fighting with and persecuting enemies. He was dominated often by unreasoning fear and was consequently cruel. Yet he was full of that faith which the animals have to such an admirable degree. Unhesitating faith in the inner promptings of his own nature. He had the joy which comes of abounding vitality, springing up like a fountain whose outlet is free and unhindered. He rejoiced in an untroubled and unbroken sense of unity with his tribe, and in elaborate social and friendly institutions within its borders. He had a marvelous sense acuteness towards nature, and a gift in that direction, verging toward second sight, strengthened by a conviction which had never become conscious because it had never been questioned, of his own personal relationship to the things around him and outside of him, the earth, the sky, the vegetation, the animals. Of such a man, we get glimpses in the far past, for the simple reason that all our knowledge of him comes through civilized channels, and wherever civilization has touched these early peoples, it has already withered and corrupted them, even before it has had the sense to properly observe them. Maybe one of the best ideas of the gulf of difference between the semi-civilized and the quite primal man is given by an author by the name of A.R. Wallace. And I quote, "A most unexpected sensation of surprise and delight was my first meeting and living with man in a state of nature with absolute uncontaminated savages. This was on the Opis River. They were all going about their own work or pleasure, which had nothing to do with the white men or their ways. They walked with free step of the independent forest dweller, original and self-sustaining as the wild animals of the forest, absolutely independent of civilization, living their own lives in their own way as they had done for countless generations before America was discovered. Indeed, the true denizen of the Amazonian forests, like the forest itself, is unique to be forgotten." End quote. Elsewhere, Wallace speaks of the quiet, good-natured, inoffensive character of these people, and of their quickness of hand and skill, and continues, I quote, "Their figures are generally superb, and I have never felt so much pleasure in gazing at the finest statue as at these living illustrations of the beauty of the human form. End quote. The immense antiquity of the Klan organization, as shown by investigations into early marriage, points to the latter conclusion. Travelers among Bushmen, Hottentots, Fuegians, Esquimaux, Papuans, and other people who have been pushed into unfavorable areas by the invasion of more warlike and better equipped races, and who have suffered physically in consequence, confirm this. Kropotkin, speaking of the Hottentots, quotes the German author Kolben, who traveled among them in 1275 or so. Quote, he knew the Hottentots well and did not pass by their defects in silence, but could not praise their tribal morality highly enough. Their word is perfect, he wrote. They know nothing of the corruption and faithless arts of Europe. They live in great tranquility and are seldom at war with their neighbors, and are all kindness and goodwill to one another. End quote. Kropotkin further says, quote, let me remark that when Kolben says they are certainly the most friendly, the most liberal, and the most benevolent people to one another that ever appeared on earth, he wrote a sentence which has continually appeared since in the description of savages. When first meeting with primitive races, the Europeans usually make a caricature of their life. But when an intelligent man has stayed among them for a longer time, he generally describes them as the kindest or gentlest race on earth. These very same words have been applied to the Ostyaks, the Samoyeds, the Eskimo, the Dayaks, the Aleuts, the Papuans, and so on, by the highest authorities. I also remember having read them applied to the Tunguses and the Chukchis, the Sioux, and several others. The very frequency of that high commendation already speaks volumes in itself. End quote. Many of the tribes, like the Aleuts, Eskimos, the Dayaks, the Papuans, Fuegians, etc., are themselves in the Neolithic stage of culture, though probably degenerated physically from the standard other Neolithic ancestors. And so the conclusion is forced on us that there must have been an immense period prior to the first beginnings of civilization in which the human tribes in general led a peaceful and friendly life on earth, comparatively little broken up by conflicts, in close contact with nature, and in that degree of sympathy with and understanding of the animals which led to the establishment of the totem system. Though it would be absurd to credit these tribes with any great degree of comfort and well-being according to our modern standards, but we may well understand that the memory of this long period lingered on for generation and generations and was ultimately idealized into the Golden Age. In contrast to the succeeding period of everlasting warfare, hostility, and strife, which came in with the growth of property, with its greeds and jealousies, and the accentuation of self-consciousness with all its vanities and ambitions. I say that each tribe at this early stage of development had within it the essentials of what we call religion, a core sense of its community with nature and of the common life among its members. A sense so intimate and fundamental that it was hardly aware of itself, but yet was really the matrix of tribal thought and the spring of tribal action. It was this sense of unity that was destined by the growth of self-consciousness to come to light and evidence in the shape of all manner of rituals and ceremonies, and by the growth of the imaginative intellect to embody itself in the figures and forms of all manner of deities. So let's discuss this a little more closely. Think about this for a moment. A bird soaring up into the eye of the sun and singing, captivated between its heaven and home, realizes no doubt, in fact, all that those words mean to us. Yet its realization is absolutely subconscious. It does not define its own experience. It feels it, but it does not think it. In order to come to the stage of thinking, it would perhaps be necessary that the bird be exiled from the earth and from the sky and confined in a cage. Early man felt the great truths and realities of life, but he could not give form to his experience. That stage came when he began to lose touch with these realities. And it showed itself in rites and ceremonies. The inbreak of self-consciousness brought out the facts of his inner life into ritualistic and afterwards into intellectual forms. Let me give you a few examples. For a long time, the tribe is all in all. The individual is completely subject spirit of the hive. He does not even think of violating it. Then the day comes when self-interest, as in apart from the tribe, becomes sufficiently strong to drive him against some tribal custom. He breaks the taboo. He eats the forbidden fruit. He sins against the tribe and is cast out. Suddenly, he finds himself in exile, lonely, condemned, and deserted. A horrible sense of distress seizes him, something of which he had no experience before. He tries to think about it all, to understand the situation, but is dazed and cannot arrive at any conclusion. His one necessity is reconciliation, atonement. He finds he cannot live outside of and alienated from his tribe. He makes a sacrifice, an offering to his fellow tribesmen as a seal of sincerity, an offering of his own bodily suffering or precious blood, or the blood of some food animal, or some valuable gift or another, if only he might be allowed to return. The offering is accepted. The ritual is performed. And he is received back. Now, I've already talked about this perfectly natural evolution of the twin ideas of sin and sacrifice. So I don't think I need to dwell on this subject. But two things we might see here. One, that the ritual, being so concrete and often severe, engraves itself on the minds of those concerned and expresses the feelings of the tribe with an intensity and sharpness of outline which no words could rival. And two, that such rituals may have and probably did come into use even while language itself was in an infantile condition and incapable of dealing with the psychological situation except by symbols. They, the rituals, were the first effort of the primitive mind to get beyond subconscious feeling and emerge into a world of form and definite thought. This just a stage further, even to the boundaries of abstract thought and philosophy. I talked about the spirit of the hive as if the term were applicable to the human as well as to the bee tribe. The individual bee obviously has never thought about that spirit, nor mentally understood what Maeterlinck meant by it. And yet, in terms of actual experience, it is an intense reality to the bee, controlling bee movements and bee morality generally. The individual tribesman, similarly steeped in the age-long human life of his fellow man, has never thought of the tribe as an ordaining being or spirit separate from himself until that day when he is exiled and outcast from it. Then he sees himself and the tribe as two opposing beings. Himself, of course, an intelligence or spirit in his own limited degree. The tribe as a much greater intelligence or spirit standing perhaps against and over him. From that day, the conception of a god arises on him. It may be only a totem god, but still a god or supernatural presence embodied in the life of the tribe. This is what sin has taught him. This is what fear, founded on self-consciousness, has revealed to him. The revelation may be true, or it may be untrue, but there it is. The beginning of that long series of human evolution, which we call religion. When the human mind has reached that stage of consciousness in which each man realizes his own self as a rational and consistent being, looking before and after, then the mind projects on the background of nature similarly rational presences, which we may call gods, and at that stage religion begins. Before that, when the mind is quite unformed and dreamlike and consists chiefly of broken and scattered rays, and when distinct self-consciousness is hardly yet developed, then the presences imagined in nature are merely flickering and intermittent phantoms. Peacement comes more properly under the heading of magic. So much for the genesis of the religious ideas of sin and sacrifice and the rites connected with these ideas. Their genesis through the inbreak or self-consciousness on the corporate subconsciousness of life of the community. We'll go on after the break to show an exactly similar process can be seen in the case of other religious ideas. So I'm going to take another musical break, and this time we're going to play Incubus Succubus, and the song is Belladonna and Aconite. Please enjoy.
Welcome back to the Soapbox Witch. Whether you're live or in the archives, you had a choice. Thank you for choosing to spend time with me.
And we're back. I want to thank you again for hanging out with me tonight. It is a Saturday night when we're live. You may be listening live or in the archives. And either way, I really, really, really do appreciate it. You had a choice and you chose to spend time with me. And I consider myself blessed for that reason. I want to go back, and for those of you who listened to last week's show, and the week before, I believe, I talked about having a guest come on by the name of the Lady Kirti Proteria. And we're going to do a show together called Living Without Labels. And I want to extend her apology and my apology for not being able to do that show this week. Something unforeseen came up. She was not able to get here at the proper time for us to do the show. She promises that as soon as possible, she will be here and we will do that show. And I don't want to do the show without her because she's got some fabulous ideas, wonderful way of looking at things in that respect. And as they say in, you know, in the theater business, I'm not going to steal her thunder. She's got some really, really good ideas that I would like for her to be able to share with you. So going on with this topic, I want to move on. I said that this, a similar process can be seen in the case of many other religious ideas. I want to consider the doctrine of the second birth. The rites connected with it in both paganism and Christianity. There is a lot to show that among quite primitive peoples, there is less of shrinking from death and more of certainty about a continued life after death than we generally find among more intellectual and what we call civilized people. It is, or has been, quite common among many tribes for the old and the decrepit who are becoming a burden to their fellow tribesmen to offer themselves for happy dispatch and to take a willing part in a ceremonial preparation for their own death. And this readiness is encouraged by their native and untroubled belief in a speedy transition to the happy hunting grounds, or whatever their culture calls it, beyond the grave. The truth is that when, as in such cases, the tribal life is whole and unbroken, each individual identifying himself completely with the tribe, the idea of the individuals being dropped out at death and left behind by the tribe barely even rises. It's not even a blip on the radar. The individual is the tribe and has no other existence. The tribe goes on living a life that is eternal and only changes its hunting grounds. The individual identified with the tribe feels in some subconscious way the same about themselves, that the soul continues. It only changes hunting grounds. But when one member has broken faith with the tribe, when he has sinned against it and become an outcast, then the terrors of death and extinction loom large on him. The wages of sin is death. There comes a period in the evolution of tribal life when the primitive bonds are loosening, when the tendency toward self-will and self-determination becomes a real danger to the tribe and a terror to the wise men and elders of the community. It has been seen that the children inherit this tendency even from their infancy. They are no longer mere animals easily herded. It seems that they are born in sin, or at least in ignorance and neglect of their tribal life and calling. The only cure is that they must be born again. Right? Obviously, they must deliberately and of set purpose be adopted into the tribe and be made to realize, even severely, in their own persons what is happening. They must go through the initiations necessary to impress this upon them. A whole series of solemn rites spring up, different in every area, but all having the same object and purpose. And we can understand how the necessity of such initiations and second birth may easily have been itself felt in every race at some stage of its evolution, and that quite as a spontaneous growth and independent of any contagion of example caught from other races. The same can be said about the worldwide practice of the Eucharist. No more effective method exists for impressing on the members of a body their community of life with each other and causing them to forget their self-interests than to hold a feast in common. I refer to it here as the Eucharist, but it has many names throughout all over the world. It's a method that has been honored in all ages, as well as today. But when the flesh partaken of at the feast is that of the totem, the guardian or presiding genii or genius of the tribe, or perhaps one of its chief food animals, then clearly the feast takes on a holy and solemn character. It becomes a sacrament of unity, of the unity of all the tribe and with each other. Self-interests and self-consciousness are, for the time, hidden, and the common life asserts itself. But here again, we see that a custom like this would not come into being as a deliberate rite until self-consciousness and the divisions consequent thereon had grown to be an obvious evil. Herd animals don't have Eucharists, simply because they are sensible enough to feed in the same pastures without quarreling over which of the tufts of grass are the richest. When the flesh partaken of is not that of a divinized animal, but the flesh of a human-formed god, as in the mysteries of Dionysus, or Osiris, or Christ, then we are led to suspect that the rites date from a very far back period when a human being, as representative of the tribe, was actually slain, dismembered, and partially devoured. Though as time went on, the rite gradually became glossed over and mollified into a love communion through the sharing of bread and wine. It's curious, anyhow, that the dismemberment or division into fragments of the body of a god should be so frequent a tenet of the old religions, and so commonly associated with a love feast of reconciliation and resurrection. It may be justly interpreted as a symbol of nature dismemberment in winter and resurrection in spring. But we must also not forget that it may, and indeed must, have stood as an allegory of tribal dismemberment and reconciliation. The tribe conceived of as a divinity, thus having suffered and died through the inbreak of sin and the self-motive, and risen again into wholeness by the redemption of love and sacrifice. This is a common recurring theme throughout the world, and it is age old. No one religion has a patent on it. Whatever views the regular members of the tribe may have taken on the matter, I think that it is incontestable that the more thought these rites as full of mystic and spiritual meaning. It is of the nature of these early symbols and ceremonies that they held so many meanings in solution. And it is this fact that gave them a poetic or creative quality, and from that their great grasp or hold on the public mind. Now, I've used the word tribe in many places in this episode as a matter of convenience, not forgetting, however, that in some cases clan might be more appropriate as referring to a section of a tribe, or people, or folk, as referring to unions of several tribes. It's impossible, of course, to follow out all the degrees of organization from tribal up to national life, but it may be remembered that while animal totems prevail as a rule in the earlier stages, human-formed gods become more obvious in the later developments. All through the practice of the Eucharist goes on in varying forms, adapting itself to the surrounding conditions. And where in the later societies a religion like Mithraism or Christianity includes people of various races, the rite quite naturally loses its tribal significance and becomes a celebration of allegiance to a particular god, of unity within a special church, in fact. Ultimately, it may become a celebration of allegiance to all humanity, regardless of race or creed or color of skin or of mind. Though unfortunately, that day still seems far distant and remains unrealized. Now, to return to the Golden Age or the Garden of Eden, our conclusion seems to be that there really was such a period of comparative harmony in human life, to which later generations were justified in looking back, and looking back with regret. It corresponded in the psychology of human evolution to stage one. The second stage was that of the fall. And so we're inevitably led to the conjecture and the hope that a third stage will redeem the earth and its inhabitants to a condition of comparative blessedness. You can never go home. Can return to that golden age, that Garden of Eden, with the understanding of what we have found through our journey of the self. We can go back with that understanding that we can, at the same time, be individuals and a whole. And that, my friends, is what I pray for every day. We are evolving. And I challenge you to be involved as we evolve. I want to thank you for tuning in and listening to my thoughts. And I want you to remember that I don't care if you think like me. I just want you to think. And if one single thing that I've said tonight in this episode strikes a chord with you, plants a thought seed in your mind and in your heart, in just one of you, then I feel truly blessed. If you like what I'm doing, or if you don't like what I'm doing, and you want other people to hear how crazy I am, let everybody know I'm here. And I will remind you that my opinion often changes. Why does my opinion change? Well, change is the only constant in the universe. And as I encounter more things, and as I bring in more thoughts, and as I process more things, my opinions change. But for me, I look inside myself, and I look to understand why I believe the things that I do. I challenge you to do the same thing. I challenge you to take it in prayer, to take it in meditation, whatever it is that you do, whatever name you put on it, look to that immanent divine. And remember that the longest journey that you will ever make is that 18-inch journey from the head to the heart. And where the head and the heart meet, that's where the magic occurs. In all things, may you blessed be. And remember always that I love you.
I pray something you have heard in this episode will make you think. I don't care if you think like me. I just want you to think. I challenge you to be involved as we evolve.